Welcome, y'all, to the Direct Examination Podcast. My name's Dane Phillips.
And I'm Joseph Bias. We thank you so much, as always, for listening. If you've clicked and downloaded and listened to this episode, actually, you don't ever have to listen to the episodes, but download them, click it. We like the numbers. It makes us feel good. Except for today's episode, because we have an illustrious guest, which we'll get to in a second. But if you are listening to us, we just ask, hey, go on your favorite streaming site, wherever you're hearing this podcast, give us a 5-star review, give us a, say nice things about us, go follow us at SC Law Pod on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. Maybe we'll add some other social media. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But if you like us, we like you. So just, you know, show it. Isn't that right, Dan?
100%. Like, share, subscribe.
Like, share, subscribe. Right, how are things with you, buddy?
It's doing great. You know, we were just talking with our guest before we got started recording and talking about that her practice is incredibly busy. I'm incredibly busy. Filed an appeal today in the Supreme Court while having to be stuck in kind of that virtual court purgatory. And so that's the best thing about virtual court purgatory is you get to put it on mute and turn off your camera and still try to get some work done. Cause if I would have had to reschedule the plea 100% if I was in a position where, I was on deadline and had to file with the Supreme Court. And, so I was able to kill two birds with one stone. It's good stuff.
Look, you know, we have nothing but the elite on this podcast as co-host. Frankly, Dane, just hearing you say that, it doesn't surprise me. You're a man of the people. You're working hard.
Well, you know, somebody's got to be out there, you know, hustling, grinding in the streets, and might as well be me.
I hear you. Look, we all don't always get, we don't get interviewed by the media. We don't get to write op-eds for local papers. We don't get to be on CNN. But our guest today does. She began her career as a public defender in Palm Beach County, Florida, before deciding, you know what? I want to go a little more red, moved up to Charleston to practice criminal defense. She's an experienced trial lawyer with Adams and Bischoff in Charleston and the founder of SC4CJR, South Carolina for Criminal Justice Reform, a statewide nonpartisan nonprofit organization that's dedicated to achieving holistic criminal justice reform in South Carolina through research, advocacy, collaboration, and education. Now, if this all sounds familiar, that's because she's been on the show before. And so if you want to go back, listen to our episode from, I believe, last June, and you can hear more about SC4CJR. That organization is made up of a group of advocates, criminologists, medical professionals, criminal defense attorneys, incarcerated individuals, philosophers, prosecutors, business owners, students, everybody who's passionate about this topic, and it's all under our guest's watchful eye. They provide research assistance to criminal justice systems and educational programming. You can learn more about SC4CJR at sc4cjr.org. You can follow them on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and before it was TikTok, but we'll talk about that in a second. Of all of the great things that we said, maybe her best honor is that she is joining our prestigious two-timer guest club. Please welcome Allie Menegakis to the show. Allie, welcome back.
Welcome, Allie.
Hi, guys. It is so awesome to be back. I am so excited and honored to be on here a second time. I was telling you guys before, I would be on here every night if I could. I have such a fun time with you guys.
We won't be here, but we're glad that you could join.
We're glad you're back. And, the nightly podcast, I don't think we'd be able to keep that rolling.
Although, I'm going to be honest, if you're a business or organization and you want to sponsor that idea for the nightly podcast, email us at directexaminationpodcast@gmail.com. We could make this work.
There's always a price.
There's always a price. Look, the $1 million man said everybody has a price. But suffice to say, Allie, we have not seen you in about half a year. We've missed you. We need to have you back on for relevant topics. First thing, how are you? How's Charleston? How are things?
Man, you know, it's been a crazy, crazy year, I know, for all of us, myself included. But I'm grateful to say that I'm doing well. I'm healthy. My family's been healthy, thank goodness. you know, our firm, we've been great in being conscious of the coronavirus. We're working from home right now. But luckily, you know, we're able to do a lot of things virtually. So it's been good. But SC for CJR, we've been really busy doing a lot of stuff. Our organization has really grown since we talked 6 months ago. So I'm excited to share some of the things we're doing with you guys.
We're definitely glad to have you. I mean, we've touched on it a couple of times in recent episodes, a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about today, but I'm glad to have another sounding board on here. You can really give us the Lowcountry perspective, as well as give us just another perspective. And for us, instead of just scratching the surface, to really do a deep dive into some of these issues that we haven't frankly done yet. And so I'm excited for us to address all this.
Allie, you mentioned the things that SC4CJR have done. Can you just give us a brief, since June, an update, a 1,000-foot view of what you guys have been up to? And if people haven't heard that last episode, first thing, shame on you. But if they haven't heard what your organization does, can you talk a little about the what y'all have been up to essentially recently?
Well, I mean, we have been up to really the same two big things that our country has been up to, and the world, frankly, the past 6 months. We've been really focusing on racial equity and COVID and its effect on people, and especially on our criminal justice system. So we've been doing a lot of work when it comes to researching those issues, educating people on those, advocating for changes in that, and collaborating with other like organizations and different organizations than us to try and get the message out on the need for a lot of things. But I'll start with a few big ones. What, you know, obviously after the death of George Floyd, there was a lot of questions when it came to, you know, use of force tactics. And especially with the protests that came afterwards, which included Charleston and Columbia and other places in South Carolina, excessive force continued to be an issue. So we have been advocating a lot. We joined with the ACLU, Black Lives Matter of Charleston chapter, and really pushing for transparency when it came to the local police departments in Charleston, specifically in regards to excessive use of force that was used against peaceful protesters back in May after the death of George Floyd. And I believe that, you know, our push for that, both in the media and educating people, resulted in the dismissal of a good amount of those charges for those young people. But we're still pushing for the rest of those and pushing for transparency when it comes to the police departments to really hold themselves accountable for how they treat civilians as well. That's one of the big things that we've been working on. One big thing that we have been doing is really working on our educational programs. So if you go to our website, there's a page on there that's dedicated to educational programs. And you can request from our organization to come to your organization or your firm or your courthouse or your school and teach about certain issues when it comes to the criminal justice system, whether it is about constitutional rights, what kind of rights you have if you're, you know, stopped for a DUI, or if it comes to what are the main things in South Carolina that need to change for criminal justice reform. So education has been a big thing there. We also on that front have a great internship program that we developed. So we are taking intern applications for the spring and for the summer right now, both at the law school level and the undergraduate level. Also, we are taking now, we have a criminologist who's one of our directors of research right now, and one of our other co-directors, Donna White, who I think is going to be joining y'all in February, who's an expert when it comes to mental health and substance abuse. We've kind of been expanding that research aspect there. So if you're interested in an internship or learning more about our organization, you can go there and find that stuff out.
I mean, the big thing is there's not many services out there that, I mean, obviously, the South Carolina Bar Young Lawyers Division has that program that I know Joseph's been involved in, and I'm currently in it. We're trying to get some stuff squared away. COVID's thrown a wrench in it, and we're trying to, you know, go to local high schools and middle schools and have panels for you know, young people to try to explain the criminal justice system. And so the fact that you can expand on it and not limit it just to schools, but also probably provide maybe even a little bit more in depth on those subject matter is pretty great, because I don't think there's anything else out there in South Carolina that exists that is going to be offering those kind of educational opportunities. So, I mean, that's obviously a good thing. You know, one of the things I wanted to bring up is the backlog of the court system, right? Obviously, with criminal justice reform, like I said, we've discussed this on, you know, scratch the surface on some of the other podcasts, but have you seen from a level, you know, kind of have your finger on the pulse is with the backlog and how it's affecting the indigent population as well as just overall criminal justice, you know, as far as your organization's concerned, is there any things that your organization's planning to address the backlog, especially for incarcerated individuals who obviously they're presumed innocent and, you know, there are many people that have a bond and it's just that by the very means of their financial situation is the reason why they're, you know, they're incarcerated.
Yeah, absolutely, Dane. I don't, you know, one thing that we're hoping to do in the future when we get more resources to do so is to really do a quantitative analysis and a data analysis of how COVID really has been affecting the court system. Some organizations are able to do it based on a jail population view. What I've seen from those numbers is that the jail population, as when COVID first started, at least in Charleston County, reduced a good amount. But I also think that there's probably a correlation when it comes to the crime rate at that time. So, you know, when everyone was on lockdown at the beginning of COVID, no one was really going to work. A lot of people were, you know, maybe laid off, weren't out, you know, at restaurants, things like that. At bars, et cetera. So there was a decrease in the crime rate and there also was a decrease in the jail population, but that has slowly been going back up. Yet our numbers are not better, right? We had 400,000 people that have been died of COVID, sadly, in the United States this month. The numbers are getting worse in South Carolina. We keep having record numbers of infections here and deaths. So why is the, you know, the jail population going up now when it's not necessarily related to COVID, it seems. So I know that there is a backlog in Charleston when it comes to the docket and the criminal court docket. There has been a backlog in Charleston in regards to the docket before COVID. And Charleston, as you know, is a large county, but is also a well-funded county compared to some other counties in South Carolina. Yet the waiting time for someone to go to trial in Charleston before COVID was over 2.5 years. Now, just imagine now that we haven't had a single jury trial in Charleston County since COVID hit this summer. And how is that going to impact that? And how much longer are people going to have to wait now? And, you know, when I went back and listened to our interview that we had in June, and we briefly touched on, you know, how I originally came from Florida. I used to practice down there. There's different rules and discovery rights and laws that you have in Florida that you don't have here that are really a lot better when it comes to defendants in the criminal justice system. One of those is a statutory speedy trial right. In Florida, when you are arrested, a clock starts to tick. If you're arrested for a misdemeanor, you have to be tried within 90 days if you choose to go to a trial. If not, that case must be dismissed by the judge. Felony, 180 days, or that case must be dismissed. Now, you have the right, the defendant has the right to waive that right, like they do all their other rights. And right. Then let's say you want to review your discovery, you want to go interview witnesses, you want to do all these things and you're not ready. Once you are ready, then you demand a speedy trial again, and that trial has to be heard within 50 days or the case is dismissed. Now, of course, there's some exceptions and there's some leeway with a few days here and there if there's, you know, serious problems in regards to the state that they can't control. But my point is that when you have a law or a rule like that, that is whole has a time limit, you are going to be moving your system significantly faster than systems that don't have that.
Well, I mean, outside of what Hunsberger, you know, there's no case in South Carolina. There's absolutely no teeth to our speedy trial rights in South Carolina. Outside of Hunsberger, you know, we have a case out there where, you know, it was 10 years of pretrial incarceration that the court approved. 10 years, a person set, you know, presumed innocent in the, you know, pretrial incarceration, that, and that's unconscionable. And so, you know, it, but many people, lay people, would be shocked to know that most people who go to trial are going to sit in jail, again, presumed innocent, for 2, 3, 4 years on average. And like you said, it only compounds the problem now that we have COVID. But the fact that we don't have any teeth, you know, there's no outside of somehow proving, you know, a pre-indictment delay and having proof of prejudice of a witness dying or inability to present a defense, the right to a speedy trial is, for the most part, meaningless in South Carolina. For the most part. I mean, obviously, you get a status conference and a judge will possibly do a date certain. But generally what happens is they'll just reschedule. They'll say, all right, you must be tried within 120 days. If not, you know, can convert to a PR bond. Doesn't necessarily mean that a trial will happen. And so there's significant policy efforts. Is your organization working on kind of having a lobbyist with the State House as far as trying to get these issues presented?
Great question, Dane. So right now we are a registered nonprofit with the Secretary of State, which is something new and awesome that we didn't have the last time we talked with you guys. We're in the process. We have hired an attorney to help us with the C3 application, but we haven't completely dismissed the idea of going for, I think it's C4 for lobbying if we did want to do that. However, you know, at this point, I think our best route is to go C3, but I don't think that, honestly, Dane, I don't think it's necessary for us to lobby for that. You know who needs to lobby for that is everyone listening to this podcast, the lawyers.
Right.
Especially the criminal defense attorneys. We know how our clients suffer, and we suffer as a result watching them suffer. There is no reason that criminal defense attorneys and our supporters and those that we have referrals with and our brothers and sisters in the civil law can't support us in trying to get this right. So I think that as lawyers, we have a duty to be pushing this in the legislature. Lay people don't really understand how it works in the criminal justice system. But as lawyers, especially criminal defense attorneys, we do. And I think that this is honestly a fundamental issue that I can't see how anyone would disagree that sitting in jail for over 2 years is okay.
So for our listeners who either aren't experienced with the criminal law system or don't know, and I know we've talked about it on some previous episodes, but basically it's to dumb it down for idiots like me. So the reason that the docket, you talked about the docket is backed up and you have 2 years, you know, to wait. That's in the control of whom right now?
That is a complicated answer because it depends on which county you're in.
Okay.
Which jurisdiction, but which judicial circuit.
It shouldn't be complicated though, Dane, right? It shouldn't be complicated because there was a case, and those that don't know it, I suggest that you look it up. It's State v. Langford.
I was at the oral argument for Langford.
You are. Okay. So you know exactly, you guys should link that in here. And I don't have the citation. Here we go. State v. Casey Langford III. And what did the court hold in that? The court held that what was happening before that case, that the solicitor was controlling the trial docket, was unconstitutional. Right.
Okay. And I hate to interrupt you, but again, in a solicitor controlled docket, that means that the solicitor makes a decision on what case to call, when they're going to call it, and they essentially put the defendants on notice. Hey, you know, the practical application of this is they put the defendants on notice, you know, the week before, you know, whenever, hey, your guy is upcoming, you know, next week, be ready to go to trial if we're going to trial. And so the effect of that, Dane, is what? As far as you representing your clients.
Right. So, I mean, again, so I'm with Ali as far as, you know, Auden is and what should happen. The fact that solicitors shouldn't have exclusive control of the docket. Unfortunately, that case, I believe, was decided in 2012 or 13. And so the reality is there are many places where the prosecutors still control the docket. and they make the rosters, they call the cases for trial, despite that being an unconstitutional practice. There are counties where there are judge-run dockets or modified judge-run dockets that are done differently. I know Charleston's run differently compared to, say, Lexington County, which is even different than, say, Richland County. Mm-hmm. To not have uniformity, to me, just proves that we're violating due process, that the fundamental fairness element is being absolutely deprived from criminal defendants, from the accused, by not having that uniform process. Because, what Joseph was trying to prevent was me getting too technical and into the weeds of this, but this has been a hotly contested battle where just recently, over a year, there was kind of this fight between the solicitors, which are prosecutors, the defense attorneys, or at least SCACDL, the South Carolina Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and then also with the court. And so there was this proposal that the General Assembly, the politicians, were going to change the law. And then they were going to say whether the Supreme Court would just issue a court rule. And there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of heated things that happened between whether the politicians were going to pass a law on this. And again, I don't want to go too far down the road with it, but ultimately it ended up going nowhere. And nothing came about. However, some of the proposals that were presented were good. You know, at least a 30 days notice. For some, if we could at least get 30 days notice, a lot of it was bad. Allie's shaking her head. A lot of it was bad. I disagreed with a majority of it. But there were some things that were good that would at least allow some people a fighting chance. Now, I didn't fully support it, but the issue is, again, I don't know how far we want to go, and I don't want to take up the whole time of the podcast, but I know Allie wants to jump in here. So jump in, Allie.
Yeah, let me, if I can, because this is such a really big issue that I'm super passionate about, and honestly was one of the main reasons that I decided to start this organization. Over a year ago or 2 years ago when I started thinking about it, was because of that Bill 444 that you're talking about. So dumbing it down super simple, Joseph, originally in this
country, like Joseph,
originally in this country, we were under English rule, right? So right. Under that old archaic rule, what would happen would be that the solicitor, which we still call it in South Carolina, that prosecutor, is the one that would bring the charges and then decide when that case was going to go to trial. And in what order compared to other cases. Every other state in the United States changed that, except for South Carolina. We were the last state in the entire country to have a prosecutor solicitor run docket, and that was in 2012. The court in Langford held that a prosecutor run docket is unconstitutional. Why? Because it violates the separation of powers. Who's the prosecutor? They're part of the executive branch. They're not part of the judiciary branch, right? So how are they allowed to control a docket and when cases go to trial? No other state ever had that. So the court finally changed that, right? And in that order, they actually had an administrative order attached that specifically directed every single lower court to follow their ruling in Langford. And to this day, that is not the case. And it should be. And that's why I say, Dane, that it shouldn't be complicated. Every county in this state should be following Langford. And those that aren't under Langford are violating the Constitution, according to that case. So,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
So Charleston, on the other hand, has changed that method and they are abiding by Langford. But this is where speedy trial comes in. So if we don't have a solicitor choosing when a case goes to trial, and in what order? Who's going to decide that? A judge? Well, how's a judge going to decide that? They don't know the evidence. They don't know what the discovery is. So how do they do it? In Charleston, they're doing it chronologically. So the oldest case goes first. That sounds great, but not all cases are the same. And that's going to take a really long time. So that plus COVID, in my opinion, and what our organization is fighting for, that yes, speedy trial, if we were to implement that right now, wouldn't make sense, right? Because we can't go to trial anyway because of the harm and the health risks. And the Supreme Court has order that we can't do that right now. Even states that have speedy trial, their speedy trial is tolled right now because of COVID. But there is going to be a time when COVID is gone, pray to God. And we're going to have to go back to our dockets, and they are going to be exponentially worse than they were before. And what are we going to do then? Are we going to go back to chronological? Some solicitors want to go back to a solicitor run docket, which is what that Bill 444 was for.
Right.
But well, I might go back. I mean, that's just for Charleston.
So how are we going to manage this overwhelming amount of cases where people's, it's not just, you know, civil cases where money's involved. This is people's liberty. So right. How are we going to deal with that? This needs to be a priority. And our argument and what we're pushing for is now more than ever, when we are done with this, that is when we need to have a speedy trial rule in this state, because that is going to automatically and naturally push the docket along in a way that is constitutional, in a way that is just, in a way that is fair, especially to the accused, because they are going to have that constitutional right to decide when they go to trial, instead of a solicitor potentially, you know, sitting on a case that maybe they don't have that co-defendant, you know, proffer yet. And like, let me wait, which is what Langford was about, right? They're waiting for that co-defendant to make that, you know, statement against the defendant and wait a year to get it out. That's not fair. You know, I know I'm really passionate about this, but it pains me as a criminal defense attorney, and I think it should pain any lawyer or any human, to know that there's people in jail that have absolutely no recourse to go to trial, whether or not there is COVID. There is absolutely, doesn't matter how good, Dane, you know this, doesn't matter how good of a lawyer you are, there is nothing that you can do to get a case to go faster than it is to go to trial in this state. And that needs to change.
Well, the only recourse you can do in, you know, in those solicitor controlled dockets is just usurp the solicitor, go through the chief admin directly, and demand a status hearing on the record where, you know, you're demanding a trial be set. And, you know, it's that's it. And there's nothing that you can do outside of whatever the chief admin judge is willing to do beyond that.
And Dane, to be clear, you know, some judges, just because I happen to know some, and I know y'all do too.
Judges, no powerful people.
Clearly. I know you and Amber. That's all I need to know. No, some judges do kind of take it upon themselves, and they do more or less control docket. And I guess they do follow Langford, whether that be for a, you know, trying to follow the constitutional decision or just wanting to have control of their courtroom. You know, some judges do that. But I think, Allie, and your point is it, because it can be different in every county, you know, some individuals are being shortchanged. All right. So, Allie, finish this sentence for me. Once COVID is over, the best way to get these defendants in front of court, in front of judges, and their cases resolved is what?
Is to enact a speedy trial rule in our state that not only covers, you know, a timeline for when a case should be dismissed following arrest, but also includes an option for a demand. And the reason why that's important, obviously, we know the state, the solicitor is the one that's bringing the charges. They have the entire power of the government and law enforcement at their hands. They can use whatever resources they, for the most part, need to gather the evidence for prosecution against a defendant. A defense attorney and a defendant, whether they're pro se or have a lawyer, don't have those resources. So the control should be with the defendant when they are ready to go to trial. And I guarantee you, just like it happens in every other state that has a speedy trial, right, that is going to filter out the cases that aren't as important, forcing the solicitor to give good offers to those defendants and focus on those more violent cases where the victims are also suffering waiting for a case to go to trial. And if we can establish a set rule like one that's in Florida or another state that has speedy trial, it is going to naturally reduce the amount of cases that we have waiting on this docket. And more importantly, it's going to be more just and more fair. And it's going to be standardized over every court in every county and state.
And of course, Allie, you're willing and able to come back on when we have a solicitor, Rod, to fight it out with the solicitor to do both sides. Look, we're trying to create content here. We're trying to, make news. And so you cursing out a solicitor and the solicitor cursing you out, that makes for good content. For
that. So. You know, though, Joseph, I will tell you that I was surprised. So, and I don't think she'd be upset telling me this, me saying this on air, but because she said it on our show before too. Our elected solicitor who was recently reelected, Scarlett Wilson here in Charleston County, she has admitted to me several times that she supports a speedy trial right. And she probably does that too. And I think a lot of other solicitors, you'd be surprised, would, because that would totally push the docket and make it faster. Now, I will say, I don't believe that Bill 444, if it's still called that, that was pushed, that Dane was talking about, is constitutional. Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, Dane, you said that there were some parts that were okay, that were good. Frankly, none of it is good because it's all unconstitutional. It should not be, we should not have to sacrifice rights and say, okay, well, at least we'll get 30 days notice. We shouldn't have to worry about that notice at all. The solicitor should not have any control over a trial docket under Lankford. And it needs to be abided by. And I get that a lot of counties are frustrated with how to move the dockets. The solution is not giving the solicitor the power back again. The solution is a speedy trial right that is in accordance with the Constitution that has teeth.
Which politician's going to champion this? That's what we need. We're calling out the local politicians, right? They come on our podcast to tell us. Joseph's like, don't go. Firing me from the podcast. He's like, hey, man, what are you doing? Yeah, right. But realistically, it's one of two ways. Either we have a champion in the General Assembly take up the issues that we're discussing, or the court decides to issue their own rule and change the system. It's going to be one of the other. You know, that's it. And, you know, I know you said that a lot of solicitors would love to see a speedy trial. That's where I definitely disagree. I don't believe, I mean, I think they would fight it tooth and nail to have a set deadline speedy trial. A lot of it dealing with some issues with the way discovery works, which is a whole nother rabbit hole. We'll save that for the next, when you come on for the third time. But it's the way our discovery process or lack thereof works in South Carolina.
The thing, though, is, Dane, that, and I get that solicitors, I think the bottom line is having a speedy trial rule would make a solicitor's job harder. Okay. But I think that that's okay when someone's liberty is at stake. And remember, the solicitor is the one that brings the charges. So if they're not ready to bring a charge and law enforcement is not ready, then they don't have to get a warrant. They do not have to indict. And they could dismiss and refile later under different charge or something like that. But I don't think that the difficulty in terms of case management for a solicitor's office should be the trumping decision on whether a defendant's rights are being respected.
Amen. And look, you got a big supporter here. You know,
so we're running low on time, and there's a lot. Legitimately, we're going to have you back on to talk about some of the other topics. And, you know, if we get you on before COVID's over in 2023 or whatever, we could talk about those things. But I want to talk a little bit, since we have you here, about the police treatment of protesters, because last time we had you on, you know, it was in the middle of the reaction to the murder of George Floyd. And what we were seeing on TV was officers throughout the nation and, of course, the state having reactions and overly aggressive actions towards these peaceful protesters. We're going to compare that to what happened in Washington and really what's happened in other states across the nation, where, you know, people with, I would say, much more capacity for violence or doing more of an outright show of force while, and I'm saying this in quotation marks, peacefully protesting. Obviously, this is something that you're passionate about as well and that you've done work on. Can you talk to me a little bit about how your organization is using what we saw this month in Washington as a comparison to what we saw last year, if that makes sense?
Yeah. You know, I'll first start by saying that, you know, our organization is a nonpartisan nonprofit. We don't take any political stance when it comes to these issues. We're not pro-Trump. We're not anti-Trump. You know, we're not trying to make any political comments on this. We're looking strictly at the issues and the criminal issues involved. But I will say that I think it would be impossible not to notice the stark difference in the criminal justice system's response to the BLM protests from this past summer, 2020, compared to the Capitol insurrection just 2 weeks ago. And two ways. One, the anticipation by the police that there would potentially be violence. You know, we worked a lot with the ACLU and BLM here and collected a lot of evidence, surveys and photographs and videos of the way that Charleston police agencies used extreme force against peaceful protesters here on May 31st in Marion Square. The amount of multi-agency efforts to silence speech, frankly, via military style, you know, less than lethal, though I wouldn't even call them less than lethal because they can be lethal, weapons against unarmed civilians, mostly young college students, was so disgraceful. Juxtaposition that to the limited response from government that they had in the Capitol when there were tens of thousands of people there at that Trump speech on the 6th. And it is scary. You know, I represented a lot of people that were arrested that day. I think you guys interviewed us when we were doing pro bono for that back in May and early June for people that were arrested in result to those protests because they didn't have representation. But some of the video footage, and you can look on our website to see some of it, is really scary. There's one video of there's got to be at least 10 officers in full riot gear marching in cadence, reciting out a cadence, and literally marching over an unarmed woman with a sign and then arresting her and carrying her off by her arms and legs. You did not see any of that a few weeks ago in the Capitol. And in that situation, you're looking at federal offenses on federal property. And then in addition to the police response, look at the court response. We don't have the data right now, but, you know, our director of research, Philip Berry, who's a criminologist out of University of South Carolina, we're going to be looking into and comparing, you know, the amount of bonds that were set in Charleston County and other places in South Carolina for these, you know, George Floyd protests compared to these capital federal charge bonds. You know, just from sitting in court and seeing them, I would consistently see magistrates setting $300,000, $400,000 bonds for some of these charges that were allegedly connected to these riots downtown. Where I've seen on the news now for some of these rioters from the insurrection and our nation's capital, looking at 10,000, 20,000, 30,000. Why is that? You know, and I'm not commenting that either one is right. I'm not saying that.
I feel like I know the answer. Go on.
I'm not saying that, you know, even those federal, those protesters and insurrectionists in DC should have gotten more, but I certainly don't think that they should be that drastically different. So again, I don't have the data to support that right now. You know, once we get more resources, we're going to be looking into that, hopefully. But it at least lends itself for us to think about how our justice system works when the media is not looking. These are cases where it was all over national television, both the BLM protests and the insurrection. And nevertheless, there's such a disparity. Imagine when the media is not even looking. What is the disparity? And that's what, you know, our organization, we want to find out. We want to identify these injustices, lift that veil and make everyone aware of it so that we can change things and make our criminal justice system better in South Carolina for everyone.
Well, and, you know, I don't know if you have it linked on your website, but I'm sure you're aware of the report done by NACDL. Obviously, I mean, your boss is the president of the organization, for goodness sakes. But, you know, they did that great kind of multi-layer report on the systemic issues with summary courts in South Carolina. And, you know, it's now brought up in the news again, I think this week, is the fact that our magistrate judges and municipal court judges obviously don't have to be lawyers, and the required amount of legal training that's involved. And look, I've taught at the orientation school for a magistrate and municipal court judges, as well as the, you know, the advanced, you know, their normal yearly training, the, what they call it, it's like advanced school or something like that. So I've taught at both things. And so I've seen obviously what their training is and how it's compared and the amount of hours. And so I think that's, you know, that's, they're the ones that are issuing these bond amounts. They're the ones signing a majority of the arrest warrants and search warrants that are out there. And so, again, another rabbit hole for that we could have a whole podcast on. But I definitely would imagine that is going to be one of the forefront issues that your organization is going to address.
Yeah, Judge Boogie is listening. He knows to do right.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, I wasn't going to speak on this really right now because I imagine we're going to have a larger development later, probably in the summer. But our organization is currently working with the City of Charleston's Special Commission on Equity, Inclusion, and Racial Conciliation, and looking at the municipal courts and the ordinances and analyzing them both on a quantitative and qualitative analysis thing. So we're hoping to have results around the summer, and would love to maybe come back a third time. And I'll bring our director of research in here and he can kind of share the results with you. But stay tuned for that.
Our future guest co-host will be back on, I guarantee you, for a third time. Allie, thank you so much for joining us. If people want more information about what your organization is doing, where can they go? Where can they follow you? And what social media platforms are you involved in?
You can learn a lot about our organization on our website at www.sc4cjr.org. That's the number 4. And you can like, share, and subscribe to us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. And Joseph, I'm sorry to say
that. Let's go. Tell me about the TikTok. Okay,
so the last time in June, we had launched our TikTok.
Sure.
I think it's my fault. It didn't do that well. And here's the thing. I am not hip. Okay. I am not a Gen Z. I'm a millennial, which turns out millennials aren't cool anymore. They have jokes about us now, the Generation Z. And, you know, we have this great Evan Noel who has volunteered to help with our organization, who's in PR. He kind of suggested steering away from the TikTok. And I feel like he was trying to say that in a nice way, basically. To
what he would say is, Bob, get off of Facebook, basically, right? Like,
He's like, stick to Facebook, Grandma. I don't think you can handle the TikTok. And I'm like, okay, all right. Maybe one day we'll have a youth person come in and figure out our whole TikTok thing. But there are still some videos on there. So if you'd like to see them on TikTok, you can.
If you happen to be on there in between the memes and the challenges, if you want to go check out some older videos before you record your hip challenge video, go to SC4CJR on TikTok.
I'm just thinking of that progressive commercial about becoming your parent.
I fuck up at those commercials. I relate. That's bad. It's bad.
I just love the fact that like you just realized you weren't cool, and like Dane has two kids and like he knows every day he's not cool. And
they're not cool.
Okay.
Right.
When did Dave Matthews stop being cool? That's my question. I learned that a few years ago. I was like, Dave Matthews concert. My cousin was like, what?
All the credibility that you had is.
All right, cut that out. Okay,
we'll cut that out. We'll cut it. Dave Matthews references out of the podcast.
Don is like judging me right now too.
Yeah, absolutely. But Allie, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll certainly have you back on again. If you want more information about Allie, obviously follow them on Twitter, Facebook. If you want information about us, and why wouldn't you? Because you're listening to the show. It's at SC Law Pod on Twitter and Facebook. We try and throw up new episodes there when they happen. You know, sometimes a little late because we all got jobs, but we throw up episodes, we make commentary, interact with us, follow us, say hello. We see everything and we love to hear from you. If you want Amber's information, it's at Red Judicata on Twitter. Amber's fine. She just had to work tonight. Dane, you can follow him at SC Crim Lawyer for the best possible, you know, criminal advice in Columbia and the greater surrounding areas. And if you want a great, great criminal representation in Charleston, go to Adams and Bischoff. And finally, you can follow me at Joseph P. Bias. I can't help you at all, but sometimes I tweet funny things. So,
unless they want to go back and get an associate's degree or
do some classes. Holler at me if you want to, be educated and smart and save money on your college education. So those are our plugs. We do them at the end of every episode, not only because we want you to love us, but because we love you. So thank you so much for listening to the Direct Examination Podcast. We have some exciting things coming up. Stay tuned. We have more illustrious guests and great legal commentary. So thanks. We love you. Bye.